Maybe it happens to you when you go out to enjoy nature. You expect to hear little more than the sounds of birds and trickling water when you're on a hike. But instead, you hear that low background roar, the almost white noise of maybe a freeway a few miles away. That has become a very typical thing in our country. Even areas far from human population have higher sound levels than they used to have, and it can affect even wilderness areas and the creatures that live in them. That's the finding of a recently published research paper called Noise Pollution is Pervasive in U.S. Protected Areas. Rachel Buxton at Colorado State University is a conservation biologist doing postdoctoral research, and she is the lead author of the study and our guest on The Exchange. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
So a very big issue and so many places to measure. How did you go about this?
Yeah, well, the National Park Service has actually been concerned about noise pollution in parks for a couple of decades now. So they've put out acoustic recorders in over 492 sites around the country for about 16 years now. So large amount of acoustic data.
And so I imagine since it's been out for 16 years in some of these cases, you've probably got long trends to be able to demonstrate.
Sure. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of sites where we've monitored year after year, but some of them certainly, you know, for about a decade now, we've been tracking what's happening with the sound.
So how, recording devices, I assume microphones or something akin to microphones and something to record what the levels are. How then do you separate what is supposed to be heard there from what is not?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, a lot of this, what you see in the paper, is largely a modeling exercise. So what we do is we use things in the environment that affect sound, and we use that to predict what the background levels are and then what the levels are as a result of anthropogenic sounds. So that's human-caused sounds.
And then how much higher above the background sounds are you finding things to be in these areas?
Yeah, well, we were actually quite surprised. We found that in about just over 65% of protected areas, we found that anthropogenic noise was raising sound levels 3 decibels above natural. And that doesn't sound like much. 3 doesn't sound like a very big number, but that's actually a doubling of sound energy above natural. And another way you can think of it is it's a 50% reduction in what's called your listening area. So if you used to be able to hear, let's say, a bird singing or some kind of nice natural sound at about 100 feet away, now you can only hear that sound from 50 feet away. So fairly significant increases in sound energy.
So is the background sound rising, and you talk about the limiting of the listening area, is it sort of like a white noise effect where the sounds are screened out by the general roar of the background?
Sure. Well, it would be the general roar of the anthropogenic sound, mm-hmm. but yes, absolutely. So we're talking about the biggest culprits here are things like vehicle sounds, aircraft, and things, sounds that emanate from energy development or any kind of natural resource development. So these kind of more consistent sounds on a landscape, yeah, are definitely the biggest culprits here.
And is there a general range of distance from human habitation you sought out? I mean, were we talking 10 miles, 50 miles, somewhere in between that most of these findings are made?
Well, that's interesting. We actually used every single protected area in the United States, and actually many of these protected areas are within urban areas. So if you think about Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C., or Golden Gate National Park in California, these are actually within urban areas. So these were among the protected areas that had the highest levels of noise pollution, which is kind of what you would expect.
So protected by the National Park Service, but protected does not necessarily mean wilderness, correct?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And wilderness are sort of their own specially designated protected areas. They're among the most stringently managed, so very little activity is allowed within these wilderness areas. And as you would expect, those are the areas where we found the least amount of noise pollution.
Rachel Buxton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a postdoctoral researcher, a conservation biologist at Colorado State University, the lead author of a paper published in Science in the May 5th edition called Noise Pollution is Pervasive in U.S. Protected Areas. Join the conversation on the exchange and maybe share some experiences of your own. Are you noticing things that you didn't used to hear out on rambles in the wilderness? 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I assume you did some categorical splitting in here, though. I mean, you took out the Rock Creek Parks and the Golden Gates and looked at some of the places that are much farther from human habitation.
Sure, yeah. And again, you know, looking at levels in wilderness areas, we found these levels really encouraging. So pretty much near natural sound levels in most wilderness areas. But even in these areas, you know, you've got a wilderness area that sits fairly close to Las Vegas. I believe it's close to Lake Mead. And in areas like that, you get sound spilling over into the wilderness area. So I think we found about 12% of wilderness areas experience that 3 decibels above background level, which is that 50% reduction in listening area. So even though these areas are fairly pristine, you know, we control most human activity within them, still in some of these areas, there's some alarming levels of noise pollution.
And I wonder, too, Rachel, if these are expressed as sudden, sharp sounds or more like a constant kind of drone in the background.
Yeah, so actually, as part of our study, we didn't really measure these abrupt sounds. We measured more the constant level of noise pollution. But absolutely, I think if we had measured that, we would have found maybe a little bit different results. And you know, those abrupt and sudden sounds can have really different effects on both animals and humans than the more constant sounds. So, yeah, a really interesting new avenue for our research.
So take us down the trail of the kinds of effects that you observe or make some assumptions about what could happen to creatures living in the areas measured.
Yeah, well, there's sort of 3 different types of impacts that noise can have on animals, particularly. These fall into the first category being what we call masking. So that's where an animal is making a sound, but that sound gets directly interfered with or covered up by an anthropogenic sound so that the other animal that's listening for it can't actually hear it anymore. So we call that masking. The second type is where an animal actually perceives a noise as a threat. So it hears that strange foreign anthropogenic noise, it perceives it as a threat, and it initiates that fight or flight response where it's scared away from the area. And then finally, noise pollution can actually distract an animal. So again, if an animal is paying attention to that strange anthropogenic sound, it may be less likely to pay attention to more important behaviors like feeding itself or paying attention to that predator that's approaching.
So are these assumptions about things that can happen, or are they observed behaviors?
Those are actually observed behaviors. And as part of our research, we did a literature review where we looked at every single type of paper that has looked at the impacts of noise pollution. And we found that one of the other thresholds we use in our paper is 10 decibels above natural. And we found that the majority of studies that have studied the impact of noise on animals found some kind of impact at that threshold. So these are real things that are likely happening as a result of noise pollution levels that we found in our study.
Particularly where you're talking about things like masking and perceived threats and distractions. I mean, obviously animals that are more reliant upon hearing than sight or smell, for example, would be more affected by this. So there'd be an unevenness in distribution within animals.
Yes, and that's actually really important because, as we all know, everything within an ecosystem is connected, right? So you get situations where even though an animal can't hear, it is indirectly being affected by noise. And so an example I like to use is there's a research that's been done on a rodent in the desert, and these rodents are scared away by noise pollution. But these rodents are also really important seed dispersers. So they actually take seeds and disperse them to different areas. So even though plants can't hear, they're actually being indirectly affected because their main seed disperser is being scared away by this noise pollution. So, you know, everything, the noise can influence really everything within a community or ecosystem.
Wow. I noticed that there was a reference to the effect on plants. I didn't realize it could be that profound. It's like the plants won't grow there if the thing that scatters the seeds that makes the plants grow there doesn't arrive.
Absolutely.
You have been scared away. Rachel Buxton, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, researcher at Colorado State University. We're talking about noise pollution extending far out from where humans hang out. Are there any specific activities, Rachel, you can point to? I know there's plenty of fracking for gas and oil in Colorado where you are. Do you have some research on just that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's actually part of my own research program is looking at the impacts of hydraulic fracturing noise on wildlife. We've seen some pretty extensive effects in things like mule deer. We're currently doing research on carnivores and the bird community. So that's something that we're actively looking at right now.
All right, so that certainly accounts for some non-urban sounds, but by and large, do the sounds that are happening just come from, in plain sounds, obviously, they come from people traveling from place to place, but, I mean, where do the majority of the sounds come from, I guess, is the question.
I guess the majority of sounds come from those aircraft. So often what happens is these aircraft are routed directly over natural areas, and the thought behind that is there's nobody who lives there. So, you know, if an accident happens, it happens over an area where nobody's going to get hurt. But a byproduct of that is that a lot of these wilderness areas become then polluted with noise because the aircraft are purposefully routed over that area.
Oh, wow. So for all the times you've looked out the plane window and thought, oh, that's cool, we can see Kings Canyon from here. It's like, well, but think about what's happening down there. Wow, that's really something to think about. Now, you know, I was thinking that there was an analogy here to seeing the night sky in rural areas. So being able to see over the light pollution and now being able to hear over the noise pollution. Didn't realize that you were talking about the National Park Service putting the microphones out. There's a whole natural sounds and night skies division.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's actually two of our collaborators on the project work for that division. And that's something that we're interested in. You know, these two things tend to be sometimes correlated. So when you think of a noisy place, often that place would have a lot of light pollution as well. I mean, especially a fracking rig per se, you know, you get a lot of noise that comes from a drill, but you also get a lot of light pollution that comes from the subsequent flaring and the lights that, you know, operate when the drill rig is drilling. So these things tend to be somewhat correlated, and so we're really interested in the impacts of both of them on the environment.
We have a phone call here. Let's go to Boyd in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rachel Buxton from Colorado State University. We're talking about noise pollution.
Thank you. It's interesting to me, your guest just mentioned light pollution. There's substantial studies indicating an alarming rate of light pollution in the national parks, and I was wondering what is the rate of increase for the sound pollution?
Okay, good question. Thanks for that, Boyd. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, that is a great question, and unfortunately it's one that we haven't been able to answer just yet. You know, a lot of these recordings were done fairly recently, so we only have sort of spot estimates for noise pollution. But as you can imagine, you know, the rate of vehicle traffic and of flight traffic has increased almost exponentially over the past 30 years. So right away there, that gives you an indication that, of course, the amount of noise pollution associated with those things has also increased massively over the past few decades.
Any chance it has gotten better because we have somewhat quieter cars and things like that now?
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's something that the National Park Service is working on really hard. You know, they've come up with different techniques of reducing noise pollution. You might have seen in some national parks, now you have to take a shuttle from the visitor center to your hiking spot instead of being able to drive there yourself. And that's a really great and easy way of reducing the amount of traffic on the road you know, by a huge fold.
So, Rachel, what do people do to build upon the research? I mean, as a scientist, you put out what your findings are, but what do you think could be done then for people to act upon these findings and look for ways to further reduce the impacts of noise far away from where people are making the noise?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things that we're looking into doing. First of all, looking at, you know, when we do reduce noise pollution, what are the impacts on the wildlife community? So, you know, you put some kind of technology in that reduces noise pollution. Is that going to make things rebound really quickly, or are they going to need extra assistance, or how's that going to work in terms of wildlife and the impacts on wildlife? And then the other thing is being more specific with where you manage noise pollution. So, you know, I mentioned aircraft. We can't do away with all aircraft. That's not really feasible. But maybe being more strategic about where you put those flight paths. So instead of having it go over this nice, pristine wilderness area, maybe line it up with a busy street that goes through the park already. And that way, you know, you save that area that was relatively pristine already, and you concentrate all the sound in one particular area. So just being smart about where we manage this noise pollution.
When you talk about applying technology, though, I mean, we're talking about things like noise dampening devices or active noise maskers, or what kind of things do you think about there?
Yeah, absolutely. So just as an example, one thing that's being innovated sort of as we speak is something called quiet pavement technology, and that's where you repave a road using pavement that's a lot more porous, and that actually absorbs a lot of the sound from both your engine and your tires. So really cool new technology. Another example is putting these masking or dampening walls around drill rigs, so to absorb a lot of that really loud sound that comes off of those rigs.
Okay, so certainly some bits of technology out there to try to keep things a little quieter than they are right now, because we are seeing noise increasing in protected areas. In fact, the report is called Noise Pollution is Pervasive in U.S. Protected Areas. Rachel Buxton at Colorado State University, the lead researcher and our guest today. Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.